Good afternoon, and welcome to the second hour of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And my name is Bill Cundiff. And our sponsor this hour is Pape Machinery, our local John Deere ag and turf dealer. Pape Machinery is located at 3119 Twin View Boulevard in Shasta Lake City, just off 55 between Oasis and Pine Grove exits. Go up and see them if you're looking for a tractor or a mower or implements. You need parts or service. They do it all up there. Or give them a call at 226-9226. A lot of knowledgeable people up there can get you fixed up and on your way. So you can also get them on the web at papemachinery.com.
And hurry up and do it before Governor Newsom's edict comes in and you don't have, you're not allowed to have gas-powered.
Oh, yeah, no gas power, yeah. We're planning ahead on that, so hopefully we'll be well prepared if that thing does actually go into effect. I think there's probably going to be some lawsuits before all that happens.
Can you imagine?
But it's set for 2023, so it's not too far off.
You have to mow 5 acres with an electric
mower. Yeah,
by the time you get to one end, you got to start over at the other end because you've been recharging it the whole time.
Just carry about 40 pounds of extra batteries with you. You'll get through it.
Yeah, no big deal. Or a really, really long extension cord.
Other than the fact, I'm not sure they have the technology for a riding electric mower yet, but hey, who knows? This is liable to spawn all kinds of technology.
Your Prius can double as a mower.
Oh, there you go.
You just drag one behind it.
Just mount a belly mower on it and there. Away you go.
Belly mower on a Prius.
There you are.
Got to be a joke in there somewhere.
Sure there is.
That's bad visual anyway. Wow. So poor Lawrence Mead has offered to come on with us today.
He's like, what are these guys talking about?
Sorry, Mr. Mead.
Are you coming? Are you from California? Have I got that right?
Yeah. I want to point this out. I'm not from here. I just live here now.
So. Okay.
I'm from two other bad places, though, that have all gone crazy, so I'm starting to feel somewhat responsible. I was born in Washington State. I grew up in Connecticut, and now I live in California, and it's like, well, what the hell? It's a total downhill slide.
Yeah, and I am from here, but I'm more and more feeling like a hostage, so I'm always planning an escape at some point.
We have neighbors escaping all the time. It's like, hey, where did those people go?
Hey.
Oh, they moved to Montana. Where are those people? Mm-hmm. Oh, they moved to Idaho. Well, what the heck?
Yeah.
Only we're going to be left at the fruits and nuts, like the jokes.
Yep.
It's all going to be true. All jokes are true at some point. Ugh. So I think we've spoken with you before. But I
you probably did a couple years ago when Burdens of Freedom first came out.
Yes.
And I did like 70 interviews about it. And
you mean you don't remember us?
Now. What's that?
You mean you don't remember us?
Well, it was so many.
I'm kidding.
The interviews were organized by Steve Manfredi, who is a publicist who does this, and we had like twice as many interviews as he expected, so that showed a lot of interest, and I was much encouraged by that.
Yeah, I saw your name pop up, and I thought, hey, wait a second, we know that guy. So not to cheat people, you're a professor of politics at New York University.
That's right.
And you wrote The Burdens of Freedom, Cultural Difference in American Power.
Yeah.
But since then, I think this is new, that you're the host of Poverty and Culture.
Well, what's happening now is we're doing a podcast based on the book called Poverty and Culture, and in connection with that, I'm writing a number of op-eds that set out arguments based on the book, and the one that you've got, the one about Afghanistan, is an example of that. The Afghanistan collapse, is the only way to put it, shows, dramatizes, really, the idea of cultural difference, because what Afghanistan represented was a complete opposite of what the United States represented. And the collapse of Afghanistan is really a tragedy much more for Afghanistan than it is for us. We're going to recover from this. But whether they recover is very much in doubt.
Yeah,
I thought your view of this, I mean, I think we've all noticed that regardless of what channel you watch, all the news is exactly the same. They seem to hit everything from the exact same vantage point. And you looked at this from a very different angle that I thought was important for people
to
think about.
It was a very interesting article, by the way.
Yeah, well, thank you. The idea of cultural difference, the idea that everyone isn't the same, all countries are not the same, all groups are not the same, that they differ by culture, that is a radical point of view, which has really pretty well been suppressed because many people think you can't talk about culture without implicitly making statements about race. And I'm not making that connection. On the contrary, my sources say very clearly that cultural difference is not about race. It's something that, something quite different. It has to do with what life's about, what people think it's about. And in Afghanistan, you see dramatized this huge contrast between the way Afghans think their, what they think their lives are about and what the United States thinks. And we emerge, although our departure was certainly embarrassing, we emerged with far better credit than they did. They are in much, much deeper trouble.
Yeah, I mean, and the culture, when it gets down to the culture, I think that's the point that that is kind of blaring at everybody right now is, you know, why did this happen? Well, it's not America, and we're not going to make it America. Their culture is just different.
Yeah, and it's not only that we can't, they're not going to turn into America, but we don't have any magic answer in which a country could turn into America. That isn't easy because it does require a certain way of life. And it just happens to be that the Western world, and especially the United States, has had a very distinctive culture for as long as it's been around. And that makes us different from the rest of the world. And that contrast holds, according to my sources, even though the West and the non-West are both very diverse within themselves. You have a lot of differences, religious, cultural, language, history, are very different from place to place. But this general contrast between an individualist culture found in the West and the non-individualist found in the non-West, that holds. And that is remarkable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's not something, I mean, you know, people say, oh, we were there for 20 years, they should have been able to run their own show. Well,
Yeah,
they've been around for thousands of years, and 20 years is nothing.
That's right. Now, you can have an impact if you stay longer. I mean, the best example here is India. The British controlled India for almost 200 years. Mm-hmm. And although it is a radically non-Western country, they were able to implant certain Western institutions. So in India, you have an elected government, you have a bureaucracy, you have a legal system. The education system also resembles what you find in England. So India has some aspects of a Western culture, and that's one reason why it is better governed today than most countries in the non-Western world. But it's still not a Western country because the bulk of the society is still living a very different life from what you find in the United States or Britain.
Right. And like you say, that was after 200 years of influence from the West, and they came up with their own version of it, which is, you know, way better than Afghanistan. But 20 years in Afghanistan, it was pretty obvious they didn't really adapt to our culture at all.
That's right. And it's not clear they could have done because they'd never really had a central government. They had a capital where there was certain people hold for offices, but they never really controlled the country.
Mm-hmm.
See, that's the thing that we don't ask about. We focus mostly on whether countries are democratic. We take it for granted that they control their territories, but they often don't. I mean, the idea that you control your territory is only true in a strongly governed country that has the rule of law, and that is what you find in the West in a few Asian countries. But that's about it. Mm-hmm. You don't find it elsewhere, and therefore there's no point in even talking about democracy until you have control of a territory.
Right, right.
But I thought your point was well made about the difference between that individual, the view of individualism that they don't share.
Yeah, that's right. It's paradoxical because you would not expect that an individualist culture, as you find in the West, would also have strong government. After all, we criticize government. We're constantly critical of our leaders. And you might think that a government like that would be weaker than you find in many non-Western countries where authority is deferred to. But the opposite is true. And the reason is that part of the individualist culture is this moralistic idea of right and wrong. I mean, people believe in things like the Ten Commandments as if they were absolutely true. And they learn these in childhood. And then from that point on, they have ideas about right and wrong. They're quite rigid in general, theoretical. And they apply them to all the situations that they encounter, including politics and government. So this is why we don't have serious corruption in the United States, because people understand that that's wrong. Sure, there are people who break the laws, but we go after them. And we actually apprehend people who hold public office and throw them in jail for that. I mean, this is hard to understand in the non-Western world, certainly in Afghanistan, where there was systemic corruption. You know, that doesn't happen in Western countries because people understand that's wrong, and the authorities have authority to go after people who break the laws, and they do so. Mm-hmm. And so we have the rule of law, and that's why the government is able to govern.
Right. And over there, I mean, their culture is... it doesn't have that built in.
No.
You know, corruption is...
They're kind of operating on the might makes right.
Yeah. I had a business associate tell me one time we were attempting to do some business in Russia, and they said you have to be very careful there because in Russia they believe if they can screw you in a business deal, which is very unethical here. They look at that as just being a better business person than you.
Yeah.
And there's the culture difference.
Yeah. Or in the case of Asia, you also have a slightly different attitude. There, I don't think they would expressly set out to screw their associates. But if conditions change and you've got a contract that makes, and the contract becomes unadvantageous because changing conditions, Asians will ask you to modify it. They'll say, well, we have to help out the other side of the bargain because they're going to lose here, so let's change the deal. Well, America, you don't do that. You make a deal, you stick with it. You know, the Asians are very sensitive to the feelings of other people around them. So what's right and wrong tends to be determined by the attitudes of those that you know personally.
Right.
See, whereas for Americans, it's much more general and absolute. You know, we made a deal here, and the rules say such and such, and you have to do it. That's all there is to it. Maybe you made a mistake. Okay, do it different the next time. But right now, the law says you got to obey it, you know, or we'll take you to court. And the judges are not on the take.
Right. And it's funny, you know, most of, if not all of your Middle Eastern countries are that way. I mean, their culture is, isn't as sophisticated, but they just look at things and have dealt with things so differently than we have from the very beginning.
Yeah.
That's just the way it is.
Yeah. See, one of the reasons we don't understand how different this is because we were that way from the start. And
right.
The reason is we inherited these institutions from the British. And the British developed them over centuries. And therefore, it's the development process whereby we got the rule of law is something we never really witnessed directly. We got it from the Brits.
Mm-hmm.
And even though we had differences with them, the idea that we were profoundly against the British, really the opposite is true. Although we didn't want them to rule us and we want to have an independent country, although that's true, the fundamental institutions in America are British. They really go to the rule of law, government by consent. That's unquestioned in America.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the constitutional details are different, but that's not really fundamental. What really matters is that we have the rule of law, government by consent, and the British have had those things for something like 1,000 years. I mean, the British genius in politics is beyond explanation. They are way, way ahead of the rest of the world in developing good government. And still today, very few countries equal them in their capacity to run a law-based and democratically-based system, which has broad consent, which is supported by virtually everybody in the country. They have other issues. They're divided over many questions, but it never affects the basic institutions. And we inherited all that. We don't even see it. We think that this is somehow easy. And we think everybody could do it, but they didn't have the same history.
Yeah, they don't have the base.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. We didn't just invent it out of nowhere a couple hundred years ago, and then you know.
Yeah,
no,
made
in
it
fact,
work.
Americans were already governing themselves, even under the British, local officials tended to be locally people who had already taken office according to the rules, and when the revolution broke out, they simply moved into the same offices the British used to hold. And people like Jefferson, he was already an experienced public official at the time of the revolution. And the same with Washington and the other leading figures. So they knew what they were doing. They were already experienced. And their issues with the British were not about that. It was about more what seemed to them more fundamental issues about taxes and control, all that. I mean, they had to worry about the basics.
Right. Yeah, because that was basically an agreed upon model.
They were unconscious of it, and they also the other thing the founders did was just assume that everybody could do the same. And ever since then, we've had an idea that we can just go out and turn other countries into democracies because it's easy. After all, we did it.
Yeah, we're going to model it for them.
Well, and the other thing is, it's like, just try it. You'll like it. You know, we have this, why wouldn't they?
And we erase
those major cultural differences. We have to take a really quick break, but we will be back with our guest, Lawrence Mead. And you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
Sometimes I want a light up underneath the no smoking sign. Sometimes I wish they'd tell me how justice got so blind. I wish they'd just leave me alone, 'cause I'm doing alright. You can take your change on down the road and leave me here with mine. 'Cause that ain't my America, that ain't this country's roots. You wanna slam old Uncle Sam, but I ain't. For my life, for the stars and stripes, may freedom forever fly. Let it ring, salute the ones who die, the ones that give their lives, so we don't have to sacrifice all the things we love, like our chicken fried and cold beer on a Friday night, a pair of jeans that fit just right. And the radio.
I thought that was a really good list of all the things we can't export.
Cold beer on a Saturday night. Yeah, they probably haven't done that over there.
They'd be like, you what?
What?
We're going to wear pants? We don't do pants. Well, we were, Bill and I were talking in the break there that, I mean, just the family situation. You know, we've seen it in this country. I don't know why this is so tough. But we've seen it with, for instance, the Laotian community that came, you know, that we brought over here after Vietnam.
Yeah.
You had the women went to school, and the men would go to school, but it was culturally inappropriate for the men to not know what they were doing.
Yeah,
so the men sat in the back. They didn't try to learn. The women did, so they were eligible to get jobs. The kids spoke the language, so they kind of ran the family.
Yep.
Turned their whole world upside down, and they lived here.
Yeah, the reason was that they're trying to apply in America the way of life that they brought from home. And that's natural, but it doesn't work very well here.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to adopt a more inner-driven style. Now, other Asians who've been more selected come in here with a better adjustment. They still have a lot to learn, but they're further along the road than people who come who are airlifted here, as the Vietnamese were, or currently the Afghans coming from the breakdown in Afghanistan. They're going to have a very tough time because all they knew was that they helped out the Americans in Afghanistan, but they don't have any idea what they're getting into when they come here. That's going to be really difficult. I anticipate there are going to be serious adjustment problems.
Well, and I don't think it's just with, I mean, Latin America. I mean, even the countries down there are so corrupt. That's why people are coming here, but they come here with no knowledge or education on how the system works, and they're going to bring that culture with them.
Yeah, that's right. See, the central difference is that they come with an attitude, very understandable given their background, they come with an attitude of survival.
Right.
For them, life is about survival. And so what you do is you adjust to demands made from you, made on you by the outside. Various forces impinge on you and tell you to do various things. So you have to do those things. And they're rather good at survival. But in America, that's not the main thing about the way life is lived. Most Americans are inner-driven, not outer-driven. They have goals that they're seeking to achieve. And they may be quite modest. They want to get a better job. They want to move to the suburbs. They want to send their children to college, things like that. But their lives are organized around those tasks. And it's that that gives the society its dynamism, the fact that people are moving ahead in their own lives and they're inner-driven. This is the thing that makes the society so productive. Mm-hmm. They're not just engaging in survival.
Right.
They are moving ahead. And it's that inner-driven quality. It's also the basis for the moral differences that I described before, where attitudes about right and wrong are inner-driven. They come from basic views about right and wrong, which people learn in childhood, and they carry with them through life. And these are not situational, whereas in the non-Western world, they tend to be situational. What's right and wrong depends upon other people's pressures around you. They tell you what's right and wrong. And you might have to go along with a corrupt arrangement because that's what other people are doing. And you go with the flow, go with what other people want you to do. Well, that's not the American way. We don't go with the flow.
Right.
We go with our inner convictions, mostly.
Right.
And that is what gives a society its crackling dynamism. People have inner views about what should be done and what they want to do. And there's debate about what ought to be done. People don't agree about that, but the actions have a depth that comes from their own convictions, whereas you typically don't find that in the non-Western world. I mean, this is what's really different about the West. It's not clear how it arose. It arose a long time ago, goes back to the Middle Ages, but we don't find anything like this in the non-Western world, even though there's so much other difference. That's the puzzle.
Yeah, that's such a great point that they have a survival mentality.
Yeah.
As opposed to people in this country have, it's achievement based. It's they want to do better. They learn the system and then they operate within it.
Well, I think the fundamental difference is that the Western view of life is an active one where people take initiative to achieve their goals. Whereas in the non-Western world, the fundamental stance is passive and reactive. People are waiting to be told what to do based on outside forces, and they don't take initiative. So what you don't find is the same depth of problem-solving that you find in a Western country. Typically, in America and in Europe, you find people who are trying to improve things. They disagree with what's going on now, and they want to improve it, and they take action. Some of this will be in government. Some will be in the private sector. Just listening to the ads on your program, these are local businesses who have different ideas about how to serve the public. And they're all trying to find a better way to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So they're inner-driven. And they're responding to the market, but they're not just surviving. They're trying to achieve something.
Right.
See, that's the difference.
So,
and,
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead. No, that's basically my point.
Well, what I'm thinking now is, okay, we have imported, tens of thousands of immigrants that have that survival mentality, which, I'm not saying that's a bad thing, but it's not our culture.
That's right.
How do you see that impacting us and them in this country?
Well, there are a number of studies that show that it takes maybe three generations for new immigrants to fully adjust to American attitudes. And in that time, they're not going to be adjusting optimally. They're going to have various problems. But eventually, the children are usually out in front of the adults. They will go to school, and they will learn a different way of life there. And that is the main experience that causes people to shift their views away from survival.
Mm-hmm.
But it takes a while. And the groups we've had recently, I'm thinking here of Hispanics coming from Latin America. Also, blacks who come from slavery initially, and you may say, well, they're not really immigrants. Well, they really are, because they came from Africa, which is a very, very different society from the U.S., and then they didn't really leave that culture until they moved from the South to northern cities in the 20th century.
Yeah.
And much of the problem we have with poverty today, I think, is due to the fact that the seriously poor are still living a life of survival, which they learned in Africa and then endured through slavery and Jim Crow for all of that time.
Sure.
And those blacks that are getting ahead are those who've gone native and become individualist. And they, in fact, are doing rather well. They're getting ahead. They're doing the things that our society rewards. Others, however, are still getting by day by day, and that is basically not very constructive. So, I mean, the recent politics has been to blame all that on white racism, but that really isn't plausible. There's no evidence that that's really true. Rather, it's because the culture is just different from what this country is based on.
Sure.
And we don't see that because we have this attitude that everyone's the same.
Right.
No, because we have to believe that.
But see, they've really embraced this victim mentality, and that tribalism that comes with victimhood keeps people stuck in places where they cannot be successful.
One of the things that you said in your article here was the non-West cultures are generally more passive than individualists.
Yes, that's right.
And that I think that says a lot.
Yeah, that's the fundamental difference, it seems to me. See, the identity politics idea that everything is due to racism, what that does is assign all power to the outside environment. The individual then becomes powerless. Or you're waiting to find out what you can do or not do because other people are going to tell you.
Mm-hmm.
See, that is very much the attitude of the non-Western world. I mean, it's
right.
A theory invented in American universities, but the basic idea is coming from the non-West, and that is very, very strange. I mean, it's contradictory, for starters. I mean, if you think you're oppressed by white people, then it doesn't make any sense to turn around and ask them to save you, which is what they're now doing.
Right.
And that's contradictory. If the oppressors are oppressing you, then the last thing you can do is look to them for a solution. Rather, you have to assign power to yourself and move ahead in the ways that you're able to do. Don't wait for them to tell you what to do. Do the things that you find constructive. I mean, that's what they ought to do, and that's what the black middle class is doing. And that is the shift that has to happen. And the place it's going to happen mostly is going to be in the schools. I mean, the most effective charter schools we have are schools in which teachers make demands on students to learn the basics of how to operate within the society, and to show good behavior, to listen to the teacher, and so on, and learn the basic skills. But then, after that, you leave school, and now you are equipped to go out and pursue your own goals, whatever those are.
Exactly. And do you think, in light of the current administration's policies on immigration, aren't we kind of green-lighting the whole come here, we'll take care of you?
Yep.
I mean, that's exactly where they're coming from.
That's right. And it also reflects, to me, one of the great virtues of Western culture is it has a strong moral commitment to helping the less fortunate, including people who are coming from other societies. We do indeed have a conviction to do that, which goes to the Bible. This is basically a conviction you find in the Old Testament, New Testament. People who are unfortunate should be helped, and we're in favor of that. But there's a limit to what we can do, and the current advocates of immigration set no limits at all. Essentially, they would have the whole world come to America and then assume that we should take care of them. Well, that's not practical. It's not even reasonable to expect that we would do that. So what's going on at the border now is a big mistake, because those people are coming in with virtually no selection at all, no preparation to come to America. They are not to be, I mean, one attitude is that if you take the initiative to travel for hundreds of miles to get to the border and then find a way to get across, then you must show some initiative. Well, not really. This isn't very hard to do. A lot of people do it, and they are admirable in a way, but that isn't the way forward, because obviously they're breaking the law. I mean, this is simply not allowed.
Right.
We can't allow that and have a legally governed society.
Well, so they're totally not equipped once they get here to be a productive part of our society, because they've told that, you know, you'll get everything to take care of yourself. Just get here.
That actually differ with that, because the advocates talk like that, but the people who are coming across the border themselves do not make claims, explicit claims on us. That's what the advocates do.
Mm-hmm.
They're behaving like individualists, actually. They're being moralistic. They think we should give everything to these people, okay? But the people themselves are usually extremely modest and indeed embarrassed. They know they're breaking the laws. They don't see they have any alternative. They feel absolutely powerless. But they don't talk like that. It's the advocates who talk like that. They're giving these people the wrong message. But they're actually the ones who are out of step. Those coming in now, they are indeed ill-prepared for America. I mean, I see this in my classes. People coming from Hispanic backgrounds face such disorder in their family lives that they have a hard time concentrating on their studies. Their problem isn't that they lack ability. It's that they're overwhelmed with an environment which they just can't get control of, because they're not used to being in control. They're not used to having things expected of them. They're used to survival, and they go on surviving in America, and it doesn't get them very far. So they, along with blacks, are the two groups which have the biggest change to make in taking on board what I call the burdens of freedom. And when they do that, then they're going to get somewhere. So we should concentrate on cultural change, on causing particularly young people to learn a more constructive way to live, and then they can make it.
Yeah, and you're right. I mean, it's not just the immigrants that have this issue. I mean, when you talk about a cultural change, that's a big step for folks when they've never known anything but that for generations.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the attitude of the advocates is that all this is due to white racism, and if whites were simply nicer to us, everything would be fine. I don't believe that. I don't think that's what's happening here. It's really cultural difference. But that doesn't make it easy. I think the shift, which has to be made by these groups, is indeed very difficult. And it does involve taking on board a set of responsibilities to yourself, which you didn't have in the old country. In the old country, you didn't really have responsibility because you were in the grip of forces you had no control over.
Sure.
That is not the case in America, and you need to accept that difference.
Well, the other thing, too, it would be, it's a very different process when you decide, I think I'm going to go live in a different country. You apply for a visa, you apply for citizenship, you have to study for a test, you have to meet requirements, you need to have a job, you need to have a place to live. I mean, there's a whole plan that goes with that, and a whole bunch of preparation that you do beforehand.
Yeah.
This business of, here's my Joe Biden let me in a free t-shirt and my snappy new backpack, and I'm going to get shoved in a van and taken over the border or however they do it.
Yeah, you got to feel for them, because they're going to hit the ground.
Different. That sets people up, I think,
well,
for
the,
very
the,
different
the groups
outcome.
Coming over the border are not going through the steps that you just described.
Right.
They're simply crossing the border illegally, and then under the asylum system, they're allowed to claim persecution in their home society, and then they get to stay.
Right, and they don't have any, there's really no plan. We have to take a really quick break, but when we come back, let's talk about that more, because I think that's, that goes really to the heart of what you're talking about with Afghanistan.
Yep.
We're actually importing it, which,
yes, we are.
Might turn out a wee bit like we've seen on the news, which is not good.
Yeah.
We'll be right back with our guest, Lawrence Mead. He's a professor of politics at New York University. You can find everything about his article and everything about the show at wethepeopleradio.us.
I'm sick and tired of people putting it down. If you don't like it here, get the heck out of town. Go and find somewhere you love. It's fine with me. With us, so you're riding with them. Make up your mind which side you stand.
these days the truth won't sell. Longer ride, I give my life for this place called USA.
That's us, that's right. Gotta love this American ride. Both ends of the ozone burning. Funny how the world keeps turning. Look, Ma, no hands. I love this American.
No, we were thinking about it the other night. We were watching a TV show, and it's a series. And actually, the series moves so fast, and the dialogue is very, very quick, and much of it is inference. And as I'm watching it, I was thinking, you know, if you were from outside this country, you wouldn't have the vaguest idea what these people were talking about.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. You would not follow it at all.
You'd be totally lost.
And I think that goes along a lot with what we're talking about, and these cultural differences in some of these countries are so 180 degree from what we live and what we believe and what we
take
just
for granted.
Seem to know
yeah.
inherently they've had no experience with.
Yeah. On the other hand, it's much worse now than it was 100 years ago. If you look at the last great immigration wave in the progressive era, in the early 20th century, the assimilation problems were much less serious. And the reason was most of those people came from Europe. And
yeah.
So they already had an individualist view of life, and maybe not as strong as Americans, but certainly more strong than the rest of the world. More strong in the countries that are now sending immigrants in large numbers, namely Asia and Latin America. Those people have a much harder time because they don't understand that living here is not a status that you get given. It's a project. You have to do things. You have to see a goal, set goals, and approach them. That is what you don't do in most countries.
Yeah,
and if you come from a world of survival, you're not going to adjust well here.
Right,
and that is their basic problem.
They not only have to learn that individualist attitude, but they have to also learn to work within the boundaries of our laws and regulations they have no idea what they are.
If there is a moral structure in the non-Western world, but it's based very much on conformity to the social pressures around you, mm-hmm. whereas for us, the right and wrong and the rule of law and so on are all bound up in moral absolutes, which we learn early in life. Now, I don't mean that we totally observe them. I don't think anyone ever fully observes the values that they hold. But the idea that these values are general and specific to our country is something that we don't find elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
In other societies, what counts is the pressures around you. So people come in here from these foreign countries, and then they imagine that they can do deals to get around the rules. You know, in Mexico, when the authorities accuse you of tax evasion, you negotiate with the tax authority. Well, in America, you don't negotiate with the IRS. Okay,
no.
You got to obey the rules. That's all there is to it. Or they come after you,
mm-hmm.
and they're totally unapologetic about that. And this is just. I mean, we have a rigid idea about the rule of law, and we got this from the British. They also have a severe view of paying taxes. If you evade the taxes, this is a serious offense over there. So for us, it's a serious offense. We go after people that do that, and we don't. Now, some people get away with it, but we don't accept it,
No. And
we don't negotiate with the authorities about this.
No.
You know, it's clear there's a right and a wrong here, and you're expected to do the right thing.
Well, do you think that the way that this is being handled, you know, people 100,000 of them at a time just being
transported.
Just brought in like, you know, goods for a store shelf, and you take them in large chunks and just dump them in a town.
Well, I don't know that that's happening if you're talking about the Afghanistan excavation or
no, that's different. But I'm talking about the southern border.
You don't mean that. That was,
yeah,
of course, authorized by the government.
Correct.
And those people are being treated as refugees, and they will be handed to various localities around the country where they will have to adjust. But most of the immigration problem is at the southern border,
yes,
where people are coming in large numbers illegally and assuming that they can claim asylum and then regularize their status later. And we know from what's going on in Congress that Democrats are trying to authorize this, that is to give legal status to the something like 11 million people that are in the country illegally.
Which is probably now, more like 20 or 25. I mean,
it could be larger. The point is, this is outside the law, and we shouldn't authorize it.
No.
Right.
This is what Republicans call amnesty, and that's exactly what it is. And I don't see how we can authorize this. I mean, what I would do is tell people to go home. I would do it gently. I would not commit violence. I would not round people up. But I would tell them, okay, we're going to change the rules. You can't get a job here now unless you're here legally, and we'll make sure that you're legal. And if you're not here legally, you're going to have to leave. That's all there is to it. And I don't think we should be squeamish about this.
Well, we've always said that if we instituted E-Verify and cut off any type of welfare benefit to illegals, then basically the self-deportation happens. And
That's right. I think that E-Verify is the real answer here. It wouldn't be necessary to formally deport people. The idea that we're going to deport 11 million people, that sounds impossible. But we don't have to deport them. We simply have to say you can't make any money now because you can't get a legal job, and you have to leave.
But in the Democrats' latest iteration of their bill, they're trying to create all sorts of welfare benefits for illegal aliens and medical care and all these kinds of things.
Yeah, sure.
So really, what's your incentive to leave is zero?
Yes, but not if you still have a job. I mean, the benefits to me are less crucial than the fact that people are allowed to find a job now.
Employers
are allowed to hire illegal people whom they know are illegal, but they don't have to really prove that they're illegal or legal. And under E-Verify, they would have to.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we should do. I think it's pretty simple. The reason we haven't done it is because business is opposed. Some businesses, and especially agriculture, find it highly convenient to be able to hire illegal workers.
Except that's like 4% of the illegal community.
Yeah.
And we did pass legislation, 2 years ago, that, what was it, the Farm Worker Modernization Act, and that did require that employers use E-Verify. The idea was, hey, if we can get this implemented in the agricultural community, then maybe we can.
Yeah, I don't recall if that went through. That would have been a huge change and a very favorable change. I mean, there is a need for farm labor. That is true. And there are some businesses where you simply can't get citizens to do the job. And we have to recognize that they're going to have to bring in some Mexicans to do that or people from Latin America. But we can still keep control of it. And we shouldn't make a gigantic hole in the system which allows people to come in any number without any real authorization. That we really have to stop that. And this is something that I think the Trump administration did correctly. You can quarrel about certain things they did as legal or bending the rules in various ways. No doubt that's true. But the fact is they cut the inflow substantially, and that was necessary, and we have to do that. I mean, I would also change the rules for legal immigration so that it wouldn't be possible to bring in so many other family members to join people that are already here. Because as it is now, every legal entry is allowed to bring in a lot of other people. So, in fact, you don't really have control. So we should limit that as well. And there are other limits we ought to make. There's a lot of problems with the immigration system.
Well, just based on your article, I think I kind of already know the answer, but when we are modeling for people who are coming to this country, whether they're coming through the program in Afghanistan or they're sneaking across the southern border, when we model for them that we really don't, give a crap about our own laws and we're not really following them,
I don't think that we give that impression in general. Once you're in the country, legally or illegally, you face the local law enforcement apparatus, which is certainly not easygoing.
Right. But don't you think that's probably kind of surprising for them?
Yep. I think that's true. And especially you can't bribe the police. You try to bribe the police, you are in serious trouble. And the police will generally refuse bribes, and you will be indicted for a serious offense. that is not allowed. And, I mean, we really, the idea that you can't bribe your way out of problems with the authorities is really fundamental to the whole idea of the rule of law, and it's generally obeyed. And so even the place where the rule of law is really broken down is at the border. That's where the rules are so complicated that everyone thinks they can cross the border illegally and then regularize their situation later. The idea is that there are so many different statuses that you can get into once you're here that you're never really going to be deported. And that is the attitude that I think Democrats have promoted. And that has to end. We have to simplify the system. It has to be crystal clear that you have to satisfy the rules, and you have to do so before you come here. You can't cross the border illegally and then regularize your situation later. If you cross the border illegally, you should be deported immediately with no further discussion.
And why do you think that seems so unreasonable to people that I'm really surprised that so many people disagree with that they can come over, and it's really not that important that they assimilate to our culture.
Well, I think the reason that drives that is essentially the moral priority of helping unfortunate people, which I mentioned before. And the impact of that is very strong. So we have all these advocate groups that want everything to be made possible for immigrants, who say truly that these people are miserable, that they're in a terrible situation, and we ought to help them out. Yes, that's true.
That is true.
And in principle, that's accurate. But we can't do it on the current scale. See, in the Bible, you never have numbers like that. You never have a society where the people who want to come in are larger in number than the people already there. I mean, there's one estimate, I think it's in that article or another one that I've written, showing that something like 700 million people in the world want to escape somehow to the Western world. And that's more than twice the population of the United States.
Yeah, you fundamentally changed our culture at that point.
Yeah. Yeah, we can't deal with numbers like that, and it's not morally reasonable to expect that. And so the moral discussion of immigration is entirely one-sided. It's all in favor of more. And there are all these groups that favor additional immigration. What they're not focusing on at all, we're not focusing on, is the need to maintain our basic culture, which is individualist. People coming in now are all coming from non-individualist parts of the world, where life's about survival, where you don't take initiative, where you don't have a personal project, where you try to get through the day or the week, and that's all you want because that's better than where you came from.
Yeah.
And that is indeed better than where you came from.
Well, I think that's a huge point, and I hope people will go and read your article. We are out of time, believe it or not.
That flew by. Thank you very much for coming on. Some great information there.
Thanks a million. Our guest has been...
Well, thank you very much, and good luck, and maybe we'll talk again.
I'm sure we will. Our guest was Lawrence Mead, and we will link his other show when I find it. You can find it at WeThePeopleRadio.us.
By barbed wire fence. MTV on the RCA, no AC in the vents. We were Jesus, Sammy, blue jean baby, born in the USA. Trailer park, truck stop, faded little map dots, New York to LA. We were teenage dreaming, front seat leaning, baby, come give me a kiss. Put me on the cover of the Rolling Stone, Uptown, Down Home, American Kids.